I think we are at a pivotal moment. And I think it's important that we do keep our perspective. It's easy to get distracted. Even like Lisa was saying during the holiday season with Thanksgiving and Christmas and all the hubbub, it's easy to get distracted and to lose perspective. And so we're doing this series, and first week we talked about, last week we talked about the separation of church and hate. That there is no place for hate when it comes to God's people. And we must treat people, even our political opponents or people who we disagree with, we must treat everyone with respect and love. We must submit to our government authorities. There is no room for hate. There should be a separation of church and hate. And like I said, today we're going to talk about trusting in God. Josiah's here, and he's a new jarhead. Everybody say, oorah. Give me a oorah. Ready? Oorah. Just got back from his, is it basic training? What's it called? Boot camp. Okay. And we're glad to have him home. And I know Mama is really glad to have him home. I think you're already emotional already just having him sit beside you. I've been watching you this morning. You know, it is easy, and some of you have served in the military. And we have young men like James, who is going to be entering just in a few months. It's easy when we know someone in the military, when we are in the military, it's easy to confuse patriotism and Christianity. It's easy to confuse those two things. Even if you're not in the military, I mean, just think about the 4th of July celebrations that we go to. You know, there are some churches who mix those two too readily, I think. Do we need to pray for our military? Oh, yes. They are, and our government leaders are appointed by God to protect and defend our country. I believe that. But still, it's easy to get those two confused. And when you look at so many other things about our country, our founding fathers, you know, a lot of them claimed to be Christians. Most of them were probably deist than Christian. But they had the Bible as a foundation, and all of our founding documents are founded on biblical principles. Did you know that every constitution, every state's constitution, there's 50 of them, refer to God and a higher power in their constitution? Our country's major anthems, like Star Spangled Banner, America, America, my country, all these things, they speak about God and their prayers. Do you know the very first book printed in America was a prayer book? And the very first psalm book ever published was a hymnal. Arizona's motto is, God enriches. South Dakota's motto is, under God, the people rule. Ohio's motto is, with God, all things are possible. Colorado's is, nothing without providence. You know, the Washington Monument, you've been to D.C., seen the huge Washington Monument, that pillar. At the very top, 500 feet tall, are these words, praise be to God. The Jefferson Memorial has chiseled on its wall this quote, the God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. And ever since George Washington took the first oath, every single president of the United States has invoked the name of God in prayer, either directly or indirectly, in his inaugural address. In every president, with almost every speech he makes from the Oval Office, ends it with the same phrase, and may what? God bless America. In God we trust is printed on our money, on every piece of currency. Now, and that is our national motto, in God we trust. You would think, with all that, that this was a Christian nation. With all those things, it is easy to get Christianity and patriotism mixed up. With all these things, you would think that America really does trust in God. But does she? Does she trust in God? Some Americans believe that that our country has special status with God, that we are God's chosen people, God's chosen nation, and that God goes with us in every battle we fight. He goes before us. And what we're doing when we think along those lines, we're taking God's words to Israel in the Old Testament, His chosen people, His only chosen people. We're taking those words and we're overlaying on our American system, and we're confusing patriotism with Christianity. We are not, America is not Israel, okay? America is not a royal priesthood, a nation of priests, a chosen people, a holy people of God. But you are God's chosen people. The church is the royal priesthood. The church has been chosen, and we are spiritual Israel. So we can apply all those things about Israel to us as the church and the individual Christians. Are you with me? Okay. So make sure we're clear on that, because I don't want to be too unclear. Let's get back to Israel. Israel was commanded by God to have one God, Yahweh. The nations around them worshiped all kinds of different gods and idols. But Israel was supposed to be special, called out, set apart, holy, unto God alone. God was to be their judge. God was to be their king. God was to be their military leader. And as long as they put their faith in God and not other things like different idols and different gods of other nations, as long as they were dedicated to God, God was faithful to them. And He did judge them with justice. And He did lead them and give them grace. And He did give them military victory. But there's a problem. If you've read the Old Testament at all, you know that Israel vacillates. They vacillate between being dedicated to God one minute and then taking their eyes off God and putting their eyes on something else and putting their trust in something else. Here's a good example of this. This is a little summary of the cycle that Israel finds itself in over and over again. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. They would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to the other gods and worshiped them. They quickly turned from the ways of their ancestors who had been obedient to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, He was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. So over and over again, you see this cycle. People stop relying on trusting in God. They start relying and trusting on other things and worshiping other gods. God sends discipline. He sends these armies in from these surrounding nations to subdue them. They cry out to God, Lord, save us. We're sorry. We repent. We confess. And what does God do? He raises up a leader. He raises up a judge to be the military leader, to kick those people out and to reclaim Israel's territory. And then after a while, they get fat and happy, being in peace, and they get distracted, and they put their trust somewhere besides the one place where they should put their trust. In that way, we are like Israel. The church is like Israel in that way. Individual Christians are like Israel. You and I are like that. We have our moments where we are, God and I are like this, right? We're tight. And then we get distracted and we put our trust in something else. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. I want to focus today on 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's not going to be on the screen. I have an audio file we're going to play, but if you want to go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, you can follow along. Let me set this up. Samuel is one of those judges that God has appointed. And he has done well. He has led well. In chapter 7, right before this, the Philistines were about to attack Israel. So the people of Israel go to their judge. They go to Samuel and say, Samuel, cry out to God to save us. And Samuel tells them, you pray, I'll do the sacrifice, we'll pray. And sure enough, God shows up. And they defeat the Philistines, bam, big time. Several years have gone by since that time. We don't know how many years between chapter 7 and chapter 8, but several years have gone by. Samuel now is an old man, okay? All right, here we go.
When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him,
you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.
But when they said,
give us a king to lead us,
this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him,
listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king, as they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do.
Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said,
this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day.
But the people refused to listen to Samuel.
No,
they said,
we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles.
When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered,
listen to them and give them a king.
Then Samuel said to the men of Israel,
everyone go back to his town.
That's Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 8. After that, starting verse 9, we see that Samuel carries out the will of the people with God's blessing, and they anoint their first king, King Saul. So let's go back through that text and just pick out a few things that we can notice. One, Israel was facing a pending leadership void. Samuel was an old man, and his sons were not like Samuel. Even though his sons had a godly position, they were also appointed judges. And even though they had godly names, Joel was one of them's names, which means Yahweh is God. That's what it means. The other one is Abiah, which means Yahweh is my father. I mean, you could not get better names for the boys of a judge of God. They were crooked. They took bribes. They chased after money. They were dishonest. And the people were afraid of the leadership void. They were afraid. We can't put our trust in these two guys. They're rotten. You're an old man. You're not going to be around much longer. We are afraid. Doesn't that sound familiar? Two potential candidates, two potential presidents who are candidates. Is there corruption? Chasing after money? Lies and deceit? Dishonesty? I'll let you draw that conclusion. Sounds familiar to me. There's a pending leadership void. We see that Israel is interested in gaining power. That's why they want a king. They want a king to go before them, to lead their military battles, an organized central government. Instead of what they have right now are these tribes, and it's like a loose federation of tribes. There's really no central government at all. And God is the king, and people living in peace. He gives them freedom to do their own thing. And then when these armies invade, God, through his judges, rounds up an army. But what they want is a king and a standing army, like we have. They want guys like Josiah, who are there and they're paid. They're full-time warriors all the time. That's what Israel wants. We want a standing army, a central government, and we want a king to rule over us. And you know what? This will bring us prestige and power among the nations around us. And it will provide for us the peace and prosperity that we want. So they're hungry for power, prestige, protection, and they want to be provided for. Does that sound familiar? Israel rejects God's reign. In asking for a king, they are rejecting God. Those aren't my words. Those are the word of God himself. In verse 8, he says, "As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods." In other words, this request for a king is no different than what they've been doing all along. Forsaking me, rejecting the reign of God. They're also rejecting the distinctiveness that God has given them. Remember, they are the only nation that is God's chosen people. And he makes them distinct. He's given them circumcision for the men. He's given them strict dietary laws. They have to keep the Sabbath and keep it holy. God is their only king. They are monotheistic. Yahweh is their only God. These are things that make them distinctive among the nations. But what they're saying is, we reject that. We want to be like the other nations. We reject God and his system of rule for Israel. We want one like everybody else has. We don't want to be distinct and set apart. The elders approach Samuel and they lay out their plan of why they want a king. And you know what? It makes sense. It really does. It's common sense. We got an old leader who's going to die any minute. We've got his two sons who are rotten to the core. We've got issues with security because these tribes, especially the ones out on the border, out on the outskirts, they are being threatened all the time by all these foreign nations. We got a security problem. Israel's tribal federation lacked unity, and they lacked loyalty. Each tribe was for itself until the crisis came, and then God would bring people together to fight their common enemy. But they lacked unity. Wouldn't it be nice to have a centralized government that can unify all of us under the same banner, under the same nation, with the same policies and treaties and international relations that all the other countries have? Something organized instead of something, this thing we have now, which is kind of an organic, just, it's kind of hard to define it. So their logic makes sense of why they want a king. But then God says, listen to them, but give them a warning. Tell them what it's going to be like. What's it going to be like if you have a king? Well, he's going to conscript your men, your boys. It's going to be a draft. He's going to draft your boys into the military service. Thousands and thousands of them. Some of them are going to make weapons. Some of them are going to work on chariots. Some of them are going to run in front of the chariots in battle, which is the infantry, the grunts, right? While the commanders and the guys with prestige, they're in the chariots sitting back. It's the grunts running up front to take the first shot. He's going to do that. And if you have a king, he's going to tax you big time. The people already paying a tithe, a 10% of the income to God. Now the king is going to take his own 10%. So their taxes are being at least doubled. He's going to take your fields. He's going to take your vineyards, which was their only method of living, surviving. He's going to take them. He's going to conscript them for his own use. He's going to give him to his cronies. He's going to take a tithe of your flocks and your other animals. It's going to be costly. It's going to be very costly. And the biggest cost is this. God says, as part of the warning, you're going to get tired of this. And you know how you've been crying out to me every time you get in trouble and I come rescue you? I raise up a judge and I come rescue you? Guess what? If you proceed this way, if you reject me as king and anoint your own king, here's what's going to happen. You're going to cry out to me, God says, and I will refuse to listen to you. That's the biggest warning of all. But guess what? The people won't hear it. They don't really listen. They refuse to listen to these warnings, and they insist that they have a king. Verses 19 and 20 says this, but the people refused to listen to Samuel. In fact, they were emphatic. They said, no, we want a king over us. After hearing all these warnings, then we will be like the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. We want to be like everybody else. Yeah, we hear what you're saying. We don't care the cost. We want a king. And this sets in motion. This is interesting. This sets in motion a series of events over and over and over and over where here Israel is rejecting God as king and wants their own king, right? If you fast forward to the time of Jesus, and Jesus is in front of Pilate, and he is on trial, the Sanhedrin, which are Jewish leaders, say this. When Pilate says, is Jesus your king? They say, no, we have no king but Caesar. They reject God as their king in Israel during Samuel's day, and they reject Jesus as their king later because they want someone they can see and touch, someone who has flesh and blood. That sounds like Jesus to me. And God relents and gives them what they want. Samuel heard all the people had said. He repeated it before the Lord. Then the Lord answered, listen to them and give them a king. How does this work? God says, here's my will. My will is that I'm your king. And by the fact you're requesting an earthly king, you are rejecting me. Then he says, but I'm going to give you a king. You want a king? I'm going to give you a king. You know, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the sovereignty of God, how God is in charge of everything, but he's not necessarily in control of every decision we make. We have free will to choose what we want to do. God, in his sovereignty, I don't understand this, so don't ask me about this and try to explain it. I don't understand it. But God, in his sovereignty, who is in charge of all things, has room, some wiggle room, if you will, to include our decisions, even if they're sinful decisions. And the very worst thing, listen, the very worst thing that can happen to you is if God gives in to your sinful choices and he gives you over to those choices. You want it? Go ahead and do it. And that's exactly what happens to Israel here. And they pay the price. And still, somehow in God's sovereignty, he uses the monarchy of Israel for his own glory. If you look through the lineage, there are some really bad kings, really bad kings in Israel. There's some good ones too. He uses the monarchy, and through the monarchy, the king's descendants, we have the King of Kings, Jesus. He is a direct descendant of King David. I think the real problem, why God said, this is a sin for you to request a king. Monarchy is not a bad thing. I don't think God is against kings. I don't think God is against different forms of, I don't think there's one favorite government that God says, yep, that form of government is for everybody. The whole world should be that. I don't think that's the case. I could be wrong. So God is not angry because they want to have a king. God is angry because They don't trust him anymore. They have misplaced their trust. And I think there's two root causes of this. One is ambition. They wanted to be more than something they were. Think back to the garden in Adam and Eve. Same problem. They wanted to be more than something they were. Satan said, if you eat this fruit, you will become like God. Oh, that sounds good. That sounds better than what we have now. And that was the whole basis for the original sin, was a misplaced trust because of desire, because of ambition to rise above and be something more than God intended. God's power, God's plan, God's protection, God's provision are not good enough anymore for them. They want to be like the nations, with their kings and central government and respected status, worldwide status among the nations, and to have all these treaties where they could bargain economically and militarily with these different countries. They wanted their own prestige. They wanted their own power, their own protection, and their own provision from, not God, a person. That got them in trouble. That means they stopped trusting in God and they're looking for somebody else to put their trust in. And then I think the second cause is they are afraid. They're afraid of what's going to happen in the future. There's a void, a pending void in leadership. They're afraid of these foreign nations, these powers that keep attacking them. They're afraid that they're going to miss out on the good things they saw that the other nations have. We want that like them. And they're afraid that God will not be the one who will satisfactorily give provision and protection. I think those are the two basic causes of misplaced trust. Let's talk about the results of misplaced trust. And this is not just for Israel, this is for us. When we take our trust off of God and put our trust on other things, then is the same as us refusing to listen and hear God, or it result in that. If you don't trust God, you're not going to listen to him. You're not going to hear what he has to say. And like Israel, you will refuse to hear God's truth if you're not trusting in him. If you don't trust in God, if you don't say, in God I trust and mean it, then you are rejecting God's reign in your life. God is intended to be your king and nothing else. God is the king. Jesus is the king. And when we put our trust in other things, we're rejecting God's reign, just like Israel. And it's easy to rationalize with logic, just like Israel did. It makes sense to do this. And there's all kinds of situations we could apply. It makes sense, if I love him, to give myself to him before we're married. It makes sense, because I love him. And we're going to get married anyway. It makes sense in Memphis, Tennessee, where there's such racial tension. It makes sense for me to keep myself separated from the other races, to live in my whitewashed little world. That makes sense. I feel safe. I feel protected. It makes sense. We can rationalize our way into anything when we no longer trust God. What does all this have to do with the upcoming election? Here's a couple things. One, don't be like Israel and close your ears and hearts to what God says. Be open to whatever God has to say to you. Listen to God more than talk radio. Listen to God more than Fox News. Listen to God more than the comments on Facebook and the postings on Facebook. Listen, open your eyes and ears to what God has to say. Recognize the truth so you can trust him. Number two, pledge your allegiance to God, not politicians. It doesn't matter if you're a staunch Democrat or a staunch Republican, or you can't stand either candidate. It doesn't matter. Your allegiance belongs to God. And then go ahead and cast your vote, but don't cast your trust. Don't cast out your trust. Cast away your trust in God. Cast your vote and trust in God. Every candidate is mortal. Every candidate, every politician is a sinner, just like you and I. They are tempted, just like you and I. They face the same weaknesses and sinful tendencies, and they will disappoint you. It's easy to forget that during the election cycle. Do not place your trust in people. Do not place your trust in a strong economy. Do not place your trust in a good education. Do not place your trust in a strong military. Do not put your trust in your bank account or the stock market or the economy or your job. Do not put your trust in those things or anything else. When you think, what am I afraid of? That's a sign right there. If you're afraid of something, then you're going to be tempted to trust something else besides God. Don't misplace your trust. God alone deserves our trust. It is easy to claim our national motto, "In God We Trust." It's easy to pledge one nation under God. It's easy to sing, "God Bless America." It is easy to do those things and make them meaningless. They're just words. In God we trust. Well, not really. It's easy to be an American Christian and not trust in God. It's easy, I should say, it's easy to call yourself an American Christian and not trust in God. I love America.
America.
I love America. I love having a democratic republic. I love that. I think it's the best form of government. With all its checks and balances, I think we are a blessed nation. So don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-America. I love America. I just think it's easy in America to misplace our trust. Maybe because we are so blessed. Let's trust in God and God alone. I have one final question for you before I sit down here. Could God look at your life and say to you, as he did to Israel, "They have rejected me, that I should reign over them"? Have you surrendered your life and put your trust in the King of Kings, Jesus Christ? He is the only one we should be putting our trust in, our complete trust. We trust him with everything that we are and have and will do and become. If you haven't done that yet, we want to encourage you. Do it now. Give your life to Jesus. Ask him to come in and take over as you surrender to him. And we want to help you do that. We're going to stand and sing a song, and I'll be in the very back with some of our shepherds. If you want to receive Jesus as your King of Kings and put your trust in him, and so you can truly say, "In God I trust," then we're